My comments, as Jago indicated, my own professional and personal interests lie mostly with Central Asia and the Caucasus, and I will focus mostly on that. Just to give a little bit of context also to the comments that Nadezhda was making in her video. Nadezhda comes from Uzbekistan, a former Soviet state, which, like many states in the former Soviet Union, has been ruled by the same individual and the same regime ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And in this way, it's typical of several countries in the region, where regimes that had their origins in the old Communist Party elite are still in power. Now, countries vary across the region. Some are more liberal, some are less so. But in general, many of these regimes are extremely intolerant of any form of dissent. And in fact, the very kinds of individuals that this panel is dedicated to discussing, human rights activists, journalists, political opposition figures, religious activists, and so on, are very often subjected to various kinds of pressure in their own countries, arrest, torture, detention, death. What we're seeing, and what's especially troubling, is that over the years we've noticed a trend in the region whereby international institutions and international mechanisms, many of which were initially intended to support human rights and support the rule of law and justice, are becoming increasingly co-opted, if you will, subverted, in some cases cloned, and used in ways that actually run counter to their original mandates. And just by way of a few examples, one could point to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE, which in itself is a fine organization. What they've been doing for a number of years is supporting the monitoring of elections in the region, and actually are issue reports, very detailed and unbiased reports, which give a real picture of the suppression of political rights in many countries. What we've seen lately is the appearance of parallel observer missions from member countries of the former Soviet Union, which take on very similar forms, use very similar language, issue very similar reports. The main difference being that these are almost universally in favor of any election that favors the ruling regime. So it's a way in which that a mechanism which has been a very effective way of spreading information and raising awareness about abuses is being copied and co-opted by parallel institutions, with the result that it throws into question all credibility and all objectivity of any sort of international reporting. We've seen also the way that countries such as Azerbaijan have used their resources to try to exert diplomatic influence over organizations of which they are members, such as the Council of Europe, which in many ways, which is supposed to be an effective mechanism for protecting human rights within Europe. We've seen, in fact, Azerbaijan becoming the head of this organization at the same time that it was putting dozens of activists, journalists, bloggers, and others in prison. So countries using their resources, using their diplomatic muscle to also see to it that institutions that should be acting as acting to protect human rights and fundamental freedoms, in fact, do not seem to be very effective in doing so. And what's more, we've seen with the rise of the so-called global war on terror after 9/11, but also more recently with the rise of the so-called Islamic State, we've seen governments very happily using the rhetoric of suppressing terrorism, suppressing countering extremism, and so on, to increase their own own repression of dissidents within their borders. And of course, the actions of governments, Western governments, including the United States, have also not been terribly helpful here. One could point to Tajikistan, for instance, the recent banning of the Islamic Renaissance Party, the most powerful opposition party in the country and the region, until recently, the region's only legal Islamic party, as an example of how this has been used. So the term demonization is used in the title of this panel, and I think it's a very apt way to describe the ways in which many governments in the region, including that of Uzbekistan or Azerbaijan or Russia, to name just three, approach and try to discredit those who present views that the regimes do not find welcome. We've also seen a disturbing tendency of authoritarian learning, if one can call it that, over the years, whereby legal means, laws are created with the very clear purpose of increasing control over the civil society sphere, are initiated in one country and picked up in another. One could point to Russia's laws, for instance, the so-called anti-propaganda law, which seeks to impose criminal penalties against anyone found guilty of spreading propaganda about so-called non-traditional sexual orientations, we see this law being now discussed in Kyrgyzstan, a country which has always been regarded as being relatively liberal. Or, for instance, laws on foreign agents now passed in Russia, whereby organizations receiving foreign funding have to register as foreign agents. We see this again being picked up discussed in Kyrgyzstan. Similarly, efforts to control foreign funding in Azerbaijan, for instance, have effectively meant that organizations, human rights organizations there, cannot receive any foreign funding at all. In fact, it's quite reminiscent of Egypt in that respect. This is all being put together, advanced at the same time that we see increasing official rhetoric about human rights activists that who are described as being agents of the West, agents of destabilization, those organizations, individuals spreading fundamentally alien and dangerous values as opposed to so-called traditional values in the countries of the region, and so on. And at the same time that this internal pressure we see is increasing and is increasingly being used or amplified through international mechanisms, we see that the repression has global reach as well. Countries in the former Soviet Union have quite often proven willing to cooperate. They have very notoriously difficult relations in a number of ways, but one way they've shown a great deal of willingness to cooperate has been to help each other taking care of dissenters. There have been a number of cases of individuals who have left one country of the region to seek shelter in another, who have been deported, extradited, returned to their country of origin, either through means which at least have the appearance of legality or simply have vanished in their country in which they sought refuge and have shown up suddenly back in their home country. There are numerous examples of this. I won't go into too much detail. But the fact remains that cooperation between law enforcement organizations and security organizations when it comes to targeting individuals such as human rights activists, such as troublesome journalists, and so on, is something that's been working very well, at least as far as the regimes are concerned, in the region. Now we see with Interpol and the use of red notices, we see that this reach is in fact going global, where now regimes can send out alerts immediately around the world to target those who have tried to go further abroad, outside of the fairly close sphere of communication and security services that makes up the former Soviet space. So, if you look at the materials that Fair Trials has provided, you'll see a number of cases, in fact, originate from the former Soviet Union. This is, of course, a global problem, and I think that the stories that you've heard today point that out quite clearly. So this is fundamentally why we are concerned. This is why we are happy to support the work that Fair Trials is doing. It's not, again, and I think Jago made a very apt point at the beginning, this is not because we fundamentally think that Interpol is bad. This is not that we fundamentally deny the need for any sort of cooperation between security services or law enforcement agencies, nor is it that we deny that threats to security, legitimate threats to security do exist. It's our position, however, that to be truly effective and not to, in fact, wind up being counterproductive, any approach to security and law enforcement that is not informed must be informed, by fundamental respect for human rights. And we think that the work of Fair Trials in this regard, with regard to Interpol, is an extremely promising area of activity, and we're very, very pleased and actually quite honored to be able to support it.
Thanks, Michael. It's very, very good of you. I think that there's an interesting point here about how creative tyrants can be in restricting free speech, democracy, and human rights. And I think that in a way this Interpol mechanism has become one of the latest creative ways of doing that effectively. And it's become two reasons. One, it's become really important because people are so desperately oppressed at home that they're having to flee, so they need global forces of persecution. But also, I think, because the rule of law, there's so little faith and trust in the rule of law within those countries that they need an external stamp of approval. And many countries are now using Interpol as a way of trying to say, look, you know, you might not trust us, domestic law enforcement agencies, but Interpol says this person's a wanted criminal too, and so that's an interesting additional use. I'd like to introduce Dr. Katrina Lantos-Sweat from the Lantos Foundation, who I think was going to speak about some Russian cases. We don't have any individuals affected directly by Russia, but the Lantos Foundation has been involved in a number of those cases. So thank you very much, Katrina.
Thank you. Well, it's a pleasure to be here for what is really a fascinating conference. I want to join with others in commending Fair Trials for their extraordinary work in this area, and I want to tell those who have shared their personal witness of what they've experienced, what they've really endured under this abusive system, I want to thank them for bringing those testimonies forward and for making this abstract problem very real and very compelling for all of us. You know, the great American political figure Adlai Stevenson once said that solutions begin by telling the truth. And the truth is that, as we've heard today, authoritarian regimes around the world are manipulating and abusing the Interpol red notice process to demonize, persecute, and hound their political opponents. That is what is happening. It is an outrage. It is a profound offense against the notion, the fundamental notion of the rule of law, against fundamental human rights, and against really all the values that we hold very sacred and very dear in our society. And I may be a little more aggressive than Jago in perhaps not being quite as willing to cut Interpol slack, because it is literally inconceivable that Interpol is not fully aware of the real-world effect of their sort of neutral approach to these red notice applications being put in by utterly undemocratic countries. Now, I acknowledge and agree with what has been said, and that is that Interpol does an enormous amount of very valuable, very important, very useful work. And to some degree, because the abuses, these outrageous abuses, have been sort of swimming in a large current of separate legitimate activity, this problem has not received very, very serious attention that it deserves. But to take an analogy that's been very much in the headlines of late, the fact that Volkswagen has made millions and millions of great cars over many, many decades doesn't cause us to say, well, you know, the fact that they cheated and lied on these emission tests and pulled the wool over the eyes of tens of thousands of purchasers and governmental agencies, well, you know, we hope that they can kind of figure that out. People are outraged. People have a right to be outraged. And I have to say in all sincerity that I think until we muster a sufficient level of outrage, we will not see Interpol itself or the countries that are significant players in dealing with Interpol, in supporting Interpol financially and in other ways, summoning and mustering the outrage to bring about real change. Now, one of the huge problems, and, you know, this is kind of like that 800-pound elephant or gorilla sitting in the middle of the room, is that the fundamental premise of the way that Interpol approaches red notices is flipped on its head. It's an Alice in Wonderland world. Their fundamental assumption is that all red notice requests from all governments, regardless of the state of rule of law in that country, regardless of the state of democracy in that country, are presumed on their face to be legitimate. And if you will, the burden of proof, and as we've heard, that burden of proof is extraordinarily difficult to meet because there's no real process, there's no real tribunal, if you will, for evaluating them, is on the victims who are desperately trying to get out from under these criminally abusive attacks on them that are sent globally worldwide, and not only put them in grave jeopardy of in fact being arrested and actually extradited to the country that wishes to more fully persecute them and deprive them of their rights, But it also has the effect of walling them off. There's no escape. There's nowhere they can go. Borders are closed to them. And even if borders aren't closed to them, one of the things that many of those who have been the subject of this red notice abuse find is that financially they then become a victim because banks close their accounts. They're unable to continue to function even if they have a degree of refuge in a place of relative safety. So this assumption is, as I say, fundamentally on its head. In fact, the assumption under which Interpol should be operating is that every legal system in an authoritarian form of government is suspected of being profoundly corrupt. Corrupt on many levels, but certainly corrupt as it relates to being used as a tool, as a weapon against political opponents. Because guess what? 95% of the time, that's the reality. That's the truth. And that's what we need to face. Now, I want to leave time for questions because, this is a conversation that we want to have. But I think that it is critically important for us to recognize two things. First of all, if we allow governments like the government of Russia, and Putin is a world-class abuser of this red notice charade, and I know of many, many cases, there was a whole range of individuals involved in the Yukos oil company, who, when Mikhail Khodorkovsky became target number one of Vladimir Putin, his personal public enemy number one, large numbers of executives and legal representatives and many involved with Mikhail Khodorkovsky got swept up in a whole range of abuses by the Russian government. And it continues to this day. There is still the first of the Yukos executives who had been arrested by Putin as the beginning play in his drama to go after his political opponent Mikhail Khodorkovsky. Alexei Pichugin remains in prison to this day. So, Russia, a big powerful country, is one of the worst abusers of this, and Bill Browder's case is another example of that. But what we know is that if countries like Venezuela, like Egypt, like Russia, and others, Uzbekistan, are permitted to continue sort of with impunity to abuse the rules of what should be and what in many respects is a legitimate and important international organization, then the legitimacy and the efficacy of that organization will be fatally undermined and subverted. And so it is in the interest of those who care about the rule of law, who care about having an effective functioning international entity that can share information about bona fide international criminals. It is in the interest of those who don't want to see that entity stripped of all legitimacy to bring pressure to bear on Interpol to very significantly. I know Jago said at the beginning that, the belief is that there are some simple reforms that can take place. I would point out that simple is not the same as easy. And they may, in fact, be simple reforms, but my guess is that without a lot of political pressure and, yes, media pressure, they will not be easy to achieve. The second thing that I would say is Fair Trials does phenomenal work. I can tell you, as somebody who's been involved not only in human rights in the United States for a long time, but in politics in the United States for a long time, we could walk outside here in Washington, D.C., a very sophisticated community. We could walk around the Georgetown Law Campus, a pretty elite group of well-informed and highly educated people, and we could sort of say, what do you know about, Interpol and the abuse of the red notice system? And if we asked 100 people, 100 out of 100 would know nothing. If we asked 500 people, 500 out of 500 would know nothing. Maybe if we asked 2,500 people, 3 might know something. So the task of educating, informing, putting the bright spotlight on these abuses is enormously important, because unless that happens, there will not be meaningful reform. That is my view. I also think it's critically important to get the U.S. government and the U.S. Congress engaged in this matter. It's my understanding that the United States, as it often does, provides an outsized portion of the funding for Interpol, and is, as we are simply by virtue of our size and influence in the world, a very big player in this world. Our political leaders have to weigh in on this issue. This has to become a topic. And certainly at a time when in the United States we increasingly are viewing Vladimir Putin, for example, as a bad actor, there should be an appetite to turn our attention to this abuse that's going on. So I thank you for the opportunity to be here, to be part of this incredibly interesting gathering, and look forward to any questions that may be coming forth. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I mean, it'd be fabulous to be able to support you with the work of trying to raise awareness of this issue in the United States. And I know the Heritage Foundation has also done an excellent report on this topic. So, you know, it's really difficult, I'd say impossible, for us, a small NGO sitting in London, to try and generate public and press interest in this issue. So it's great to hear that you're keen to get involved in mustering the outrage here in the United States. That's very exciting for us. I am a bit of an optimist, I have to say. I think we're at a really pretty good time in terms of being able to make these changes happen. And I think this getting the US support is really crucial. But there is a huge amount of interest and support, I think, within Interpol itself now. They're really waking up to the fact that this problem is undermining their reputation. They want to be the James Bonds of this world. They don't like getting the negative press that is generated by cases like Bill Browder's and many others. So that, you know, that's a key issue. The new Secretary General is keen to make changes, has identified the fact that that Interpol's reputation needs to be protected, and they need to work hard at that. Since publishing the report we published in the end of 2013, there's been a fair amount of press. Nowhere near enough, I completely understand that, and a lot within the European Union generated in relation to this topic. And it is that, you're absolutely right, that is the thing that Interpol responds to. And it then looks to its member countries and says, are we going to be able to get away with introducing the kinds of reforms needed to stop stories like these? And that's the critical issue. Because I'm an optimist, I'd like to just hand over to my colleague Libby to just say a few words about some of the positive developments that have already started to happen since the report was published in 2013. Thanks, Libby.
Thank you, Jago. And I just want to add my thanks to all of the presenters for joining us and for giving such fascinating presentations. And, of course, to Georgetown Law for hosting us today. As Jago said, my job is to bring the presentations to a close with some good news to show how our campaign to persuade Interpol of the case for reform is starting to pay off. And there have been a number of positive developments in the past year which suggest things are moving in the right direction. And indeed, during Interpol's General Assembly in Rwanda last week, the winds of change were clearly audible in some of the key speeches and resolutions which were passed. And I'll refer to these more specifically in the next few minutes. The first key development relates to the initial review which is carried out by Interpol officials when one of its members requests publication of a red notice. In our report, we express concern that the use of what's known as the iLink system, which enables members to circulate information very quickly across the globe and enabled member countries to post draft alerts directly onto Interpol's database without any compliance check prior to publication. We were concerned that this meant that these alerts were able to travel a long way, including onto national databases, before they'd even been identified as such and removed by Interpol. In March 2015, the Secretary General of Interpol informed us that process has now changed to introduce what's referred to as a pause mechanism, so that all red notices are now reviewed before any publication on their system. Now, we're still unclear as to what exactly that review process looks like and whether or not the substance is sufficient to ensure that all misuse of Interpol's system is identified, but certainly the timing of this review represents a procedural improvement. The next development relates to Interpol's constitutional obligation to uphold the spirit of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Having worked on a number of cases which involved serious human rights issues, including particularly those cases where red notices had been published in relation to people who had been tortured or were at risk of being subjected to torture upon return to the country which pursued them, we made a recommendation in our report that Interpol should publish guidance on how it interprets and applies this obligation relating to human rights protection. And we were therefore delighted that during the General Assembly meeting last year in 2014, Interpol resolved to do exactly that. And we're currently awaiting an update on the development of its repository of practice on this particular issue. Having heard the accounts of Benny, Nadezhda, and Patricia, you'll be able to understand why we express such serious concern in our report about red notices being published in relation to people who had been recognised as refugees in need of protection from persecution in their country of origin. In May 2015, Interpol confirmed the introduction of a policy on the processing of red notices against refugees, which provides that red notices should no longer be allowed where the status of refugee has been confirmed in relation to a particular individual and where the notice has been requested by the country in which that individual fears persecution. And we've already started to see the positive impact of this new policy, with a number of people we've worked with, including Nadezhda, having had their alerts deleted relatively quickly after we notified them, Interpol, of their refugee status. The final development also began during last year's General Assembly meeting, with the introduction of an internal working group at Interpol, which has been established to examine various aspects of the way that Interpol processes data. As has previously been mentioned a few times today, one of our main concerns has been the absence of an effective, fair, open and impartial avenue of redress for victims of unfair red notices. The Commission for the Control of Interpol's Files, or the CCF, is an internal body which is tasked with the job of dealing with individual complaints relating to alerts, and it simply doesn't fulfil this role. It operates without transparency, without respect for due process. It meets for only 12 days each year. It takes, in some cases, over 2 years to reach a decision on an application. And when those decisions come, they are not well reasoned in the slightest, and they're not even binding. The working group met for the first time in July this year and invited Fair Trials to present to one of its sessions. And while this working group examining the role of the CCF won't be reporting to the General Assembly until next year, we're encouraged by the steps which have already been taken. In a resolution passed when it met last week, the General Assembly decided to task the General Secretariat to consider specific proposals for the reform of the CCF. And the key moment will obviously come at the end of next year when it presents its final recommendations. But we're pleased that the Secretary-General described the role of the working group as being to help build a more robust system that will ensure compliance with international standards and consequently improve protection to the organisation from litigation. Clearly recognising here that until reforms are made, Interpol remains vulnerable to criticism and its credibility is threatened. So while there is still work to be done, we feel like we're moving in the right direction. And we will certainly continue to pursue our reform agenda over the year ahead. Thank you.
Thanks, Libby. So we have about 15 minutes for questions and comments from the floor. I'll take comments now. So could you please introduce yourself and ask the question for panelists?
Hi, my name is Bruce Segaris. I'm an attorney here in Washington. First of all, congratulations to the organizers. I think this has been a great program. Congratulations especially to Fair Trials for the fact that it has engaged Interpol. I think a lot more needs to be done. As I mentioned before, I think one of the areas that there needs to be much more reform is in areas other than red notice. For instance, you mentioned the blue notice with respect to Mr. Broder. There's a lot of activity right now with respect to supposedly stolen and lost passports. That's being used by, for instance, Syria and a number of authoritarian governments to also demonize or cause to be arrested people that are just advocating for democracy. I think a lot can be done in this country. I think it partly needs to be done by building a better coalition among the human rights organizations. Also using media like the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. I know they've already done some work in this area, but I think a lot more can be done there. And just grassroots work that needs to be done. But, you know, I think that for especially a tiny organization, you guys have done fantastic work, and also the other organizations like the Open Society and the Hope organization, you deserve a lot of congratulations, but there's a ton of more work that needs to be done.
Thank you very much. Other comments, questions, observations from the floor? Thank you.
Ted Broman with the Heritage Foundation. Thanks very much for an excellent panel. Enjoyed presentations from all members of the panel. A question first about other forms of abuse. The gentleman who spoke just before me mentioned blue notices. There are other colored notices as well, of course. There's also an entire parallel diffusion system. And the diffusion system can contain exactly what a red notice contains, but it is subject to no prior scrutiny by Interpol whatsoever. And I'm reliably told that it is possible and, in fact, encouraged by Interpol computer systems for nations to submit a diffusion notice at exactly the same time and through exactly the same computerized form that they use to request a red notice. That is, when you submit a red notice request, the system pops up a box. You're asked if you want to put a diffusion out at the same time, and there it goes. So while I applaud the idea there should be a pre-publication check on red notices, and I've called for a similar thing in a paper I wrote, I don't think that comes close to touching the nature of the diffusion problem. The question that I'd like to ask is, one of the sanctions that Interpol's Constitution provides and its rules on the processing of data provides is the ability to suspend a nation from accessing Interpol-maintained databases if they are found to be persistently abusive. There are many nations to which this could be applied. I'm embarrassed to say that the former Secretary General of Interpol, an American, described the idea of suspending nations as, quote, one of the worst ideas he had ever heard of, in spite of the fact that it is contained in the rules of his own organization. I wonder if the current Secretary General has been any more forthcoming about the possibility of applying Interpol's actual rules to the persistently abusive nations that use Interpol systems.
Thanks very much. I'll let Libby, if that's all right, respond to the first point about diffusions. Are you right to respond to the first point about diffusions?
Yeah, my understanding, Ted, is that the pause mechanism applies to diffusions equally as to red notices. That was the understanding that we had been given. But I'm interested to hear that you don't consider that to be the case. Okay.
Yeah, let's talk, because obviously that's a very, very significant point. In terms of sanctions, I don't know what the current Secretary General's view is on sanctions. And, you know, I'd be interested to hear other people on the panel's views on that. Our position at Fair Trials has not been to call for suspension of individual members, partly because I don't think in practice that's something that, that is likely to happen within Interpol. It's very unlikely that any member countries are going to back the use or... there was one case in which... a Kazakh case in which a red notice had been refused against a former Kazakh presidential candidate. And there was so much of a collegiate mood in that case, in the Kazhegeldin case, amongst member countries, that actually at a General Assembly they overturned the decision to move the red notice in relation to that individual. So I think the idea that you're going to get sufficient political backing from member countries to actually allow that kind of system to operate. I think much more effective will be trying to get some greater disclosure and publicity around individual decisions when there's a review of a red notice. I think that's a really good way to start, you know, showing what's happening and how individual countries are abusing a system. If you start publishing basic information about the decisions to say, yes, there's a pattern of abuse from Uzbekistan. I know in practice that Interpol does review certain countries' requests more closely than others, and I know it's difficult for Interpol's General Secretariat to highlight which countries they are. But actually, if you had an independent oversight system that was able to publish some basic information, we'd very quickly get to see which countries are repeatedly abusing that process. Any other?
Well, I was just going to say that particular case you cited where the General Assembly overruled, I think does point to the fact that there are some very deep-seated structural problems with the way Interpol works. And, which is why I do think that to get truly effective, far-reaching reforms, and thank you, the gentleman from Heritage, for pointing out that, you know, and the lawyer as well, that there are more pervasive issues than just the narrow issue of red notice. That was clearly a political move. I mean, of the 190 Interpol members, how many would be categorized as not free? How many would be categorized as having severely compromised legal systems and severely compromised rule of law? We have to look at some of the deeper issues, I think, in order to get really meaningful reform. And that, I think, was clearly an abuse by the General Assembly to reinstate that red notice, and calls into question the fidelity of Interpol to its charter, you know, and to its constitutional mandate to be completely non-political.
Thank you very much. Two more comments. First hand up was here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. First, I just want to ask, is this proceeding being recorded, and is it going to be disseminated on the Internet? Okay, so that's going to make a difference of what I can share here. So privately, I will make some other comments, but my experience with Interpol actually came not by choice, but by circumstance when my father was put on the red notice for bringing up corruption issues in Afghanistan. And I myself, and I'm an attorney, and I was trying to assist in what he could do. And I actually see Michelle Eslin here. She's an attorney in Florida. And I came across Fair Trials from back about 2008 or 9 when you began this work, trying to find out what kind of redress is there. Luckily, he was a U.S. citizen, so he could be here, but he could not travel back to Afghanistan because of these charges against him. So it really, one thing that it does is that it gives credits to that corrupt government that they tell the people on media, we'll see Interpol put this person on the list. So people assume that there must be a separate process and Interpol found them guilty, right, of some crime. And we know that that's not the case, that they just take that notice and put it in their system, and Interpol says, we're not part of the adjudication, we're just trying to put these warrants because of what this government has issued to us. So it was a very difficult process, years of these false accusations on media and dealing with the Afghan-American community, because they assume that Interpol has a separate process, which what came to my mind is, why don't they? Why isn't there an appeal process? So my question is, first, is there a part of the recommendations that there be some type of appeal for individuals, and what would that entail? Because, as you know, they would tell you, go back to that country to fight your case, but how can you do that when that was the problem to begin with? That's not a source of redress. So this appeal and how it would work is very important. Number two, I then came across the Interpol red notice procedure more from a technical perspective. Ironically, I had an Afghan citizen who was doing business in Eastern Europe ask me to represent. I said, well, I didn't have much luck representing anything with my father. This is the way the system works, but let's give this a try. And we've been working on this case and, you know, dealing with the CCF where they'll say, in 2 months, we'll give you an acknowledgement that we received your documents. And this person is being really, you know, harmed. And this is a business case. And that's another point I wanted to make is that in addition to political interest, there's many time business interests that people have. And there's lots of corruption going on. And they don't get as much support because they weren't a journalist or somebody who was voicing something related to human rights. But they have property or assets, and someone wants them out of the country so they can seize what they have. So this is another trend, and I don't know if you are following the business as well as political aspects. Thank you.
Okay, so we'll respond to those two questions. I mean, the Fairchilds has a view. Do others on the panel have any comments in response to those questions?
Well, I would just say I'm reminded of the poignant words many years ago now of a former cabinet member. I think he might have been in the Reagan administration. I'm not actually sure. His name was Ray Donovan, and he was charged with a series of fraudulent, corrupt practices as a contractor. He had been a businessman, and he and the other defendants were acquitted in pretty short order by a jury in what was viewed to have been an unfair case. But when it was over, his quite poignant comment to the press was, where do I go to get my reputation back? And I thought of that as you talked about your father and how the simple fact of being listed, even if you are able to get it taken down, as having had, you know, what people view as an international arrest warrant put out by this respected organization, Interpol, there is an assumption that you're a bad guy. And where do people go to get their reputations back?
Thank you.
I would agree in this regard because I've fought the charges back and I went back to Egypt and I actually was arrested in order to bring the attention back to my case and my colleagues who were on the trial. And that was one of the talking points, because I was released later, a few days later. And one of the things people didn't know is that Interpol said no to the Egyptian government when they requested the extradition for all of the defendants on the cases. And it was a media battle in order to bring that point to everyone to say, no, Interpol did not approve of the Egyptian government. On the contrary, it said it was a political decision, and it said it was against their mandate in order to bring it. And actually, the other point which I was made is that we were, one of the accusation is we were distorting Egypt's image abroad, mm-hmm. because we were talking about human rights issues and abuses by the government. And one of the point I was always making is that the Egyptian government is distorting Egypt's image abroad by appearing to be political and not withholding rule of law and by abusing international mechanisms. And I think this is one issue we can highlight to the media if there was an effort to highlight the cases where Interpol have said no and make a report about that.
Thank you. Because of time, in terms of the appeals point, we're about to we've been asked to give evidence to the this working group looking at how they will restructure that whole appeals mechanism. We'll be putting in a submission, which will go on our website. So if you can give us our contact details, we can send that through, because that will explain what we think the appeals mechanism needs to look like. There'll also be a survey of practitioners there. So if any of you have experience of Interpol that you would like to share with us, then we can make sure that experience of lawyers that have tried to use the existing flawed mechanisms, you know, is reflected in that process. So if you can just make sure you give me or one of my colleagues your card, we can deal with that after the meeting. One final comment. Sorry, there was one person who going to speak. Thanks, Michelle.
You can hear me from here. My name is Michelle Esland. I do full-time work as a part of my practice. And And first, I have to say, truly congratulations to Interpol Trials for getting traction and obtaining engagement with Interpol, which has been, it's been amazing, and we're grateful that you've been able to do that. And I hope that you continue to have success with that. I can support you in any way I can, and I know many people who are here feel the same way. Second, thank you very much, especially to the journalists who are here. We know that our work benefits from what you suffered through and what you're willing to publicize. I'm very appreciative of what you've gone through. My question is this. I wonder what Fair Trials or any of the panelists think about the idea of the CCF having kind of a multi-tiered approach to the red notices that are received. And when I say that, I mean acknowledging what one of the panelists said is that, you know, we don't have everybody coming in from a level playing field. Not everywhere is Denmark. We've got places that should really be evaluated differently when they're making their requests, especially when we have different specific types of crimes being alleged. For example, financial crimes that are very easily fabricated. Or if we have countries like Patricia Paleo would never have been on Interpol's list if Interpol had looked at what it has previously acknowledged to be problematic, which was Venezuela's misuse of the red notice system. They had to go to Venezuela to have meetings about this issue. So I wonder, what is the thought about having some sort of mechanism where when we get here, as if I worked there, when Interpol gets the question of can we have a red notice from this specific country, could this country be treated differently because, for example, on the corruption index, they're at a certain score versus another country that is at a completely different level? Do you have any indicia or reason of thinking that there might be some openness to an idea like that?
Okay, so sadly that's the final question that we have time for from the floor. What I want to do is to give the panelists an opportunity to make any final comments if they have any specific responses on that. Libby, do you want to just briefly explain what our kind of approach to that question is?
Well, I mean, what I can explain is what the little bit that we do know about this review that's being conducted, this doing the pause mechanism that I mentioned. We know very little about it, but what I have been informed is that what is being applied is some form of algorithm that takes into account the country that's requesting the red notice, the type of offence to which the red notice relates, and this is somehow being applied in that review process. Now, I don't know a huge amount about it or how this algorithm is being developed, but it certainly sounds as though the approach is something along the lines of what you're describing. The other thing that we will be calling for in this paper that Jago mentioned is that CCF decisions should be in some way published, whether or not heavily redacted, that's fine, but that somehow there should be a development of the practice so that member states, NCBs, have an ability to reflect and see what is expected, but also those people in the General Secretariat who are carrying out the review have something to reflect back on, as you suggest, so that they can learn from what's happened in the past.
Thanks very much. Thank you. Patricia, please.
Okay. Yo creo que Interpol debería tener algunos países en noticia roja, como países como Venezuela, que ha utilizado Interpol reiteradamente para perseguir, por ejemplo, ¿no? Y cuando llegara una noticia roja de un país como Venezuela, analizar o revisarla un poco más. No sé si quieres
traducir. Sure. I think Interpol should issue red notices for certain countries. Countries like Venezuela, for example, that have been abusing this mechanism to persecute people so many times. When the request comes in, the approach should be flipped around somewhat.
Cuando yo entré en la pelea legal para que Interpol me sacara de sus listas, una de las respuestas que recibí de uno de los altos funcionarios de Interpol es que ellos no querían entrar en conflicto con Venezuela y con los países aliados de Venezuela porque podrían entonces retirarse del convenio y eso por supuesto no le conviene a Interpol.
And when I went to the legal area to get myself removed from the list, one of the responses I got from the official was that I needed to think about the possibility that Venezuela and its allies might simply leave Interpol and what that might mean.
Y efectivamente, cuando me sacaron a mí de Interpol, la fiscal general de Venezuela, que es una ficha del gobierno, por supuesto, viajó personalmente a Francia a quejarse de que Interpol me hubiera sacado a mí y a otras personas de las listas.
And in effect, when I was removed from the list, the Attorney General of Venezuela, who's very much a pro-government person, traveled to France to complain that I and other persons had been removed from the list.
Thank you very much. Any other closing comments from the panelists?
Well, I would just very much endorse the sort of proposal that you have made, and I love Patricia's idea, but I think that that's essential. It's very appealing to say all countries are treated as being on an equal footing, but we are talking about a fundamental issue of rule of law. And we are living in an Alice in Wonderland alternative reality if we don't recognize, and as you suggested, there could be sort of established criteria. You know, you could have 10 organizations that evaluate corruption levels, evaluate different things, and depending on where a country came out with their score, their, you know, sort of rule of law score, that would subject them to a much higher degree of scrutiny for any red notice request. I think that's got to be a part of any really meaningful reform.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to get back to a couple of points that were made. It's quite true that obviously red notice is not the only thing that is not working as it should at Interpol. I think there's no dispute about that. But I think red notice is symptomatic of something and addressing, but I think also offers an entryway into something fundamental. And that fundamental thing is accountability. There is no, or has been no accountability, no transparency about this entire process. People, there's no way to find out if you're on a red notice until suddenly, you know, you happen to Google yourself or try to cross a border. There's no way to find out, you know, or very little means by which to find out why you're there. And I think this is a fundamental issue of accountability. And I think red notices gives us something that we can use to as kind of a wedge to pry open the space at least a little bit and get some idea about what's going on and how this whole process works and how it can be influenced to work better, and by better I mean with regard for fundamental rights and freedoms. So, you know, I think, and I agree wholeheartedly with the point about the need for greater visibility about this. I mean, many of us have heard the word Interpol. Until I met Jago, I think I didn't have much of an idea about it beyond sort of the James Bond issue. So I think it's essential that there be more knowledge and more information about this organization. And I think Red Notices offers a great way, a very compelling way, to get that story out.
Thank you very much.
Can we convince a James Bond character to speak about this? I think that will make a lot
great
of difference.
Idea.
I have to say, it's you guys that are the James Bond characters, I think, tonight. It's the people that have been directly affected by this system that are willing to actually come onto a public platform and to talk about how they've been affected, because it's really that raises it beyond a difficult, interesting issue for diplomacy and law. It's actually something that's messing up people's lives. And it's something that's messing up the lives of the people we most need to protect, the people who are actually fighting so hard to advance free speech and advance human rights and advance the values that we share. I'm really grateful to all the speakers tonight. It's been a really fascinating discussion. I'm really excited and hopeful that we can get involved with some of the organisations here this evening to really try and muster that outrage that I think you're absolutely right we need to muster in order to get this higher on the agenda in the United States. But, you know, as ever, I'm particularly grateful to the individuals who not only went through the horrendous ordeal of finding themselves chased globally by Interpol, but also are willing to help try and fix that problem by speaking about the issue. And I think in your own ways in this room, hopefully you can help to muster a bit of outrage. You know, if it's possible for you to share the short film that we've produced that's on the website, that first one I tried to show, you know, please, just to try and raise awareness of this issue, follow what's happening on the campaign. Lawyers that are in the room that have experience of trying to battle this beast of an unaccountable organisation, make sure we've got your cards, because we want to hear your experiences so that we can feed that into our work. So, thanks again to everyone, to our host, Georgetown Law, Human Rights Institute, the speakers, and to you, the audience. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to be on with you.